Blog Talk Radio.
Find ourselves pulled up to the table, needing to connect again. And that's probably one of the better parts of the week, at least for me. So much happening, and it's an interest. You may find this a bit maddening, but I like the contrast. I like the contrast between the way this lifestyle called masonry provides perspective. At least it does for me. Keeps the big picture in mind when I'm looking I'm surrounded by the meagerness sales, everything, you know, I live in an environment of a capitalist environment, and that thrives on the on sales. Ideas are sold to me. Products are sold to me. Need is sold to me. You know, they can conjure up that I have a need I didn't know I had, and then sell me the solution to that need. Attempt to sell me a focus for my day, to show me what I ought to be spending my time doing rather than leaving it to me to sort it out for myself. I can look at an app and while away hours because it's curated for me, and there's, you know, these lovely algorithms that are fed bits and pieces about my demographics, and then in turn begin to churn out likables, things that will fascinate. Now, if I'm doing that, and I'm following your lead, you've curated this for me. Whoopee! You know, that's altogether wonderful. But how is that benefiting me in any way? It isn't really. It's like slumber without the fun. It's like a dream without the connection. It's really, in a way, reduced me to being an audience, to being a commodity. I'm not too really good at that because this, as I said, this wonderful contrast through masonry. And when I talk to some very lovely masons who are very self-aware, very engaged, they found their form of meditation, and then you realize, oh my goodness, it's not just sitting in a lotus position, looking out over the beach on a sunny, warm morning. There's so many different forms of mantra, so many forms of focus. We can use different words, but they're all very affirmative, cleansing and I like to think. Sometimes I think that masonry is like the philosophical version of Buddhism. You know, you can practice whatever faith you. My goodness, Buddhism is not at all at odds with any of it, and I find masonry like that. Masonry is not at odds with your belief patterns. It's simple. It's simply illustrating that. In addition, you may not be found the bliss that Joseph Campbell taught us about. You may tire of being threatened into compliance. That you may not be really sure about this whole concept of good and evil and heaven and hell. You may have started to look at the history of and development and the, my goodness, 2023, we're looking at reinterpretations of Aramaic and finding, oh my goodness. And then where did those 14 books of the Bible go? You know, really, why were they removed? Those are questions that, in a way, they would upset that sense of that we're looking at a perfect world as long as we don't ask too many questions. Eh? We're looking at that at arm's length, and we're able to examine it, and we're quite detached. And what I love about masonry is the attachment. It doesn't tell me what to do. It gives me ideas. I have this idea about critical thinking, not criticism, not a put down, not trying to best you, not at all, but critical thinking to deconstruct something that's happened. Yes, I know you're going to say, but it's a snippet in time. You have to do it. You learn from stereotypes. Yes, I do. But I'm also aware that nothing stops because I want to pick something up and examine it. We are still catapulted through the universe. And yes, I know that protons are still bombing through me and everything else. I know that. I know that there are questions about time-space and this infinite universe. Don't get me started. I know. Shouldn't we talk about that? Yes, of course. Where did that come from? We're waiting for the tool. So what happens if we're waiting for another tool to come along that's going to teach us so much more about the state of existence? My God, it's wonderful. Now, I know that we're not going to rid ourselves of cynics. Masonry hasn't, but it provides, it doesn't even attempt. It doesn't even attempt. It gives us a concept. Westgate, well, we've played that up here. It's about knowing that this is tough, and it's tougher. Being a Mason is tougher for some men than others. So not to be elitist, but find people that are like-minded. At least find that compatibility in your lodge so that you can enjoy each other's company. What, you need the never-ending challenge of people with different ways of approaching life, different levels of ability, and you're thinking that is going to be, that putting that mix together is not going to be explosive? Come on, we know better. And what to do with the criticism that you're being an elitist, you know? Well, that's not the intent, but it's certainly understandable that people would feel that way. I think the truth is that we sort. If you said to me conceptually, we are all equal, we're all alike, I would say absolutely, absolutely. But in fact, if when I go up to the window and look outside, I notice the difference. I notice the difference. I notice the, you know, all of the, I still notice when all of the young people are striving for their independence, that they're all basically wearing a uniform. And I like that. I did when I was that age. I had the, you know, but of course it was formal denim and then a tie-dye t-shirt and whatever. We tell ourselves on one hand, we are all alike. And at a certain level of abstraction, we are. But we are all so, so lovely and diverse. We have agency. We have different histories, different aspirations, different, and we have different motives, different capacity for observation. And we learn, the nice part is we learn from each other. We learn, but not all. And that's where I was fascinated. I was listening to a story, an explanation tackling, you know, this question that's come up quite frequently now about the role of religion in our lives. And we're seeing some remarkable conversations taking place. And yes, some of them are quite imaginative and enlightened and compelling, wonderful. It does not, however, address the fact that we can are never really able to rid ourselves of those menacing, you know, cynics that always seem to pop up. They seem to be part of it. You and I can want that perfection as much as we possibly can, but I would fail. I would be failing to if I thought that it happens without that baggage being part of it. The perfection that I have in mind includes all those variations, includes the fates, the unexpected things, the unexpected consequences of well-thought-out actions. All of that is part of the perfection. And yet I have this notion that I don't even know if I can even describe it anymore, because it, you know, we will sit down and start with a discussion about a line being just a continuous series of dots, and it's not. It's not. Great joy sorting that out. I'm handed, you know, you and I are taught about the geometry. We hail the geometrist. But oh my goodness, when it comes to actually applying that, I see the theorem, and it's fascinating and it's reliable until a better machine comes along and improves on it. But the work of it is translating, absorbing those principles. And if you and I sit down to talk about what that would mean, I'm pretty sure, and I would hope, that we will be on different levels, different planes, we would talk differently about. And I love that. For somebody to, a pundit to say, well, you can't agree, I think they're missing the point. We are agreeing. We are agreeing that we have different opinions. We are agreeing that we want to share them, because by sharing them, we learn more about ourselves, knowing the opinions of others. Not only about topics, but about other people's opinions about us. We can make this very, very difficult if we simply dig our heels in and say, "My goodness, this is so hard." It's what we teach our children about mathematics and science here in this part of the world. We teach them that this is unwanted, like learning a second language for a lot of children. Here, we're taught that it's a burden. Yes, we do that. And then we can be very sanctimonious that the children, and blame it on our children. They, you know, they're not happy with it. They don't have the ability. Those are quite common default statements. And they're just so manipulative. We could say that we're given a proposition that would make life this beautiful garden, where we would replace our conflict with understanding. It would not, though, rid us of conflict. It would not, no. But it does give us a sense of bearing. I know that we don't have answers for it just because we ask questions. I know that some answers come relatively easy and others require a great deal of effort. And if we give up too soon, then we're simply limiting ourselves. In the meantime, we can be free to blame the world. Oh, there's no answer for that, or you're wrong, or I'm right. And we can do that. And we do all the time, but it's not to say that this is the way the teachings of Masonry. Again, while we're thinking about it, you need to only to ask yourself, why do you believe that this is part of the fabric of Masonry, to ask these questions? Why do you think that a philosophical understanding is the backstop for ritual that isn't, we're taught it's not a religion, but somewhere in there we weave in patterns of belief. You take what you can, you take what you need. Well, this doesn't work as deeply as words in a page. We have to roll up our sleeves, build our alchemist's laboratory, and put it to the test. We need to do the work for ourselves. We need to mix the chemicals, read the formulas, study, look at the outcomes, and then realize what it is what has happened and what we've found. This is where I think we realize the cheapness of assumptions, the cheapness of many opinions. They're cheap and they're comfortable. They're like the junk food of thinking. And we're taught as Masons that exists along with this whole idea of truth. So some of you and I begin to wonder about what it feels like to pursue truth in living and in the company that we keep, we're taught, this is not something that we're born with, but we're taught to be hesitant. We're taught that there's safety if we stay in our very comfortable spot. Don't ask questions. Don't challenge. Here's Masonry coming along saying you don't have to be rash about it. My goodness, no. But think about it. Think about, is it a determinist world where we're following the directives and thinking of others? Is that Masonry? Is it a series of directives, or is it the ultimate bank feast for free will to exercise its processes? That doesn't say that everything coming out of us is going to be right. Everything is not going to be right. It's not to say that our lodges are going to be full of enlightened, lovely chaps who are well-read and contemporary, where they have opinions that matter. that they have the patience to sit back and listen to our opinion and exchange ideas with us. There's none of that. Have you noticed? And if you read the charges, I think, well, you know, I don't understand the structure. There's things about the structure I don't understand, but I'm not there to necessarily understand it, am I? This is the best that we have in this area. So, okay, that's what it is. It's not to compare it with over there. Why is it so much more detailed and encouraging over there? Well, because it's over there, because it has a different history, a different culture surrounding it than we do. And that's neither good or bad. It is what it is. And do we have that depth? Oh, yeah, we do. Always have. But do we celebrate it? We're a little more boyish about that. We're not too sure that the celebration wouldn't mean a loss of control. I don't know what we do with this whole picture of big ego and that kind of thing, except I know what we're taught. We're taught in Masonry that it's not going to help us. It's not going to take us far, that in fact it's limiting. So it's not to say it's okay that only applies to me. No. It applies to what? All of us? The world? Every man? Well, we would need to think about that, wouldn't we? A thinking man's game, a thinking man's process. As much as we begin to say what it is and what it isn't, we'll find that there will be some contradiction. It's much more than that. And that's one of the most beautiful parts of Masonry, is this dependence on diversification and this constant state of renewal. Do we work with our own experience? Well, that is kind of limiting there, gentlemen. If you're only limiting your opinion and your sense of rightness, correctness, and purpose to your own experience, I think that's a bit risky, because we have hundreds of years of accumulated focus on these topics that just come up. They just happen to be there when Masonry is being discussed. And it's a lot of it has to do with the wise. I don't mean YMCA like the song. No. Those are or none of that. I'm thinking about the whys that come in with it. The why of being, the why of purpose, the why of understanding, the why of awareness. And I think, you know, it's interesting, and some of you are not going to like this, but I think awareness happens whether we like it or not. You think that we just can dumb it down? No. Do you think about, look ahead, think about the effect of your maturity and your experience on those days as you begin to also experience your own sense of mortality. Things become important that weren't before. Do you face your regrets? Well, I'm the only one in the room that has regrets. The rest are just untarnished. They can keep telling themselves that up until that one moment when they can't deceive themselves anymore. And it comes. That's one of the delightful backstories to a life. All of this comes to us all, like the sense of accountability. Well, we're ultimately not always able to be accountable for ourselves. You think about the tragedies and, you know, the biases and prejudice that some parts of our society bear far more than the rest of us. Is there a sense of fairness? Well, if I know where I found it, and it's not in the pocket of an oligarch or the cuffs of some politician. No. It's the trust that I feel when I'm with people that are trustworthy. And the rest doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. We get by. We do. We apply our awareness in different aspects of our life, but we practice. We practice masonry because it's a very, very beautiful methodology, and it fits. It just fits. The other things that fit, like music. Let's see if we can enhance this whole conversation with a bit of a taste of mathematics being delivered to us by courier. Here it is. This is Kenny Burrell and Jimmy Smith. Just incredible, incredible together.
Check.
Beautiful. Help me with this, brethren. If awareness is secondhand, history equips us with clarity, but not in all cases. History, as Dr. Margaret Macmillan has written, is prone to being abused to suit particular narratives. It's not statistics that are being manipulated to achieve an outcome. It's history. Where censorship and scars are censored, we can find happiness believing what we are told. The hold is what many of us call loyalty. It has a powerful hold on its citizens. If that's what it takes to be happy, to swallow the thinking, why are the papers full of sensationalism? It boils down to culture. Until we are uprooted and thrown into a cauldron of critical thinking and truth, our culture is strong. Or so we say. Inserting truth into the mix tends to be startling. Truth isn't pretty, but it's necessary to achieve insight, truth. Look at the variety of Masonic interpretations around us. We may long to be that reserved, calculated lodge built on legacy and wisdom, beautiful shrines to our order, but they are a rarity. When we pick up our tools, it doesn't automatically make an artistry flow through our hands. We may be very bright, intense Freemasonry. We may be real narcissistic nuisance, easy to identify and ignore. Acknowledging divergent opinion is not suggesting anything goes. A literalist would want to press that point. Without singular thinking, we risk chaos. It is a well-worn and wrong-minded assumption in the context of Masonry. Masonry is where the human spirit is liberated. Our methods are not single events, but bundles of collateral influences at a point in time. Because we are always admitting somebody into the order, in a way we are tethered to our start point on bended knee. However, time pushes us into tomorrow. What have we learned? How do we apply that learning in real life? With humility. When we learn rhetorical strength, we can press one another until we find the best outcomes. If a man finds happiness, who am I to deny him? Been a while since I played any Herbie Hancock, but yeah, there we have it. Poetry, always a joy. Why poetry? Well, you tell me if the things said about poetry are, have you found them to be true? Do they refine thinking? Does poetry improve awareness? Does it express the soul of the world, the earth itself? Does it take us out of ourselves? Well, your application is where we would find that. I'm not speaking to people that are just wrinkling their nose and thinking, you know, it's something that I'm unfamiliar with. Well, most of Masonry is, we begin with that. It's we're not familiar with it at the start, but it's like after a while, yeah, I knew that, but Masonry points it out. This night, this day, we're looking at the work of a fellow by the name of Gerald Manley Hopkins. He's a British poet and a Jesuit priest, which makes me want to know more about the man. He was born in 1844. He's considered one of the most individual of Victorian writers, and his work wasn't published. Yeah, this is what I love about it. It wasn't published in a collective form until 1918, but it influenced many leading 20th century poets. Just very briefly, he was the eldest of nine children of Manley Hopkins, an Anglican, who had been in British Consul General in Hawaii and had himself published verse. Hopkins won the poetry prize at the Highgate Grammar School in 1863, was awarded a grant to study at Beloit College in Oxford, where he continued writing poetry while studying classics. In 1866, in the prevailing atmosphere of the Oxford movement, which I'll leave it to you to read about, which renewed interest in the relationships between Anglicanism and Roman Catholicism, he was received into the Roman Catholic Church by John Henry, later Cardinal Newman. The following year, he left Oxford with such a distinguished academic record that Benjamin Jowett, then a Beloit lecturer and later master of the college, called him the Star of Beloit. Hopkins decided to become a priest. He entered the Jesuit novitiate in 1868 and burned his youthful verses, determining to write no more as not belonging to my profession. And until 1875, however, he kept a journal recording his vivid responses to nature, as well as his expression of a philosophy for which he later support in Dun Scotus, the medieval Franciscan thinker. Hopkins' philosophy emphasized the individuality of every natural thing, which he called inscape. To Hopkins, each sensuous impression had its own elusive selfness. Each scene was to him a special scene. In 1874, Hopkins went to St. Buenos College in North Wales to study theology. And there he learned Welsh, and under the impact of that language itself, as well as the poetry and encouraged by a superior, he began to write again. He was moved by the death of five Franciscan nuns in a shipwreck in 1875. So he broke his seven-year silence to write the long poem, The Wreck of the Deutschland, in which he succeeded in realizing the echo of a new rhythm, which had been long haunting his ear. Don't you love this language, eh? He also wrote a series of sonnets, strikingly original in their richness of language and use of rhythm, including the remarkable The Windover, one of the most frequently analyzed poems in the language. Of course, that's not what I'm going to be reading today, of course. It's called The Windhover, W-I-N-D-H-O-V-E-R. This is the man. This is his friends continually urged him to write, but he resisted. All that he saw in print in his lifetime were some immature verses and original Latin poems in which he took particular pleasure. But he died, like all people, of typhoid fever. And he was born in Glasnevin Cemetery in Dublin. And among his unfinished work was a commentary on the spiritual exercises of St. Ignace of Loyola, founder of the Jesuit order. After his death, a fellow by the name of Robert Bridges began to publish a few of the Jesuits' more mature poems in anthologies, hoping to prepare the way for wider acceptance of this style of writing. But in 1918, Bridges, also the poet laureate, judged the time opportune for the first collected edition. It appeared but sold slowly. Not until 1930 was a second edition issued, and thereafter his work was recognized as among the most original, powerful, and influential literary accomplishments of the century. Now, hope you're sitting down for this. In a marked influence on such leading 20th century poets as T.S. Eliot, Dylan Thomas, W.H. Auden, Stephen Spender, and C. Day Lewis. And we've showcased those poets on the Sonic Effects, I think all of them. Hopkins sought a stronger rhetoric of verse. His exploitation of the verbal subtleties and music of English, of the use of echo, alliteration, and repetition, and a high compressed syntax were all in the interest of projecting deep personal experiences. But enough. Here. So what does it all mean? At its core, his poem is "My Own Heart, Let Me Have More, Have Pity On." My own heart, let me have more, have pity on. Let is a poem about the struggle of the human condition. Speaker is grappling with his own mental anguish and searching for a way to alleviate his suffering. And through his use of you look for this yourself, you'd be my jury, please. And through his use of language and imagery, Hopkins emphasizes the cyclical nature of mental torment and the futility of searching for comfort within oneself. So we're talking about something real here, my goodness. He also offers a glimmer of hope, encouraging the speaker to focus on something outside of himself and let joy into his life. And in the final stanza, he offers a sense of transcendence and spiritual awakening, suggesting that there is a way to move beyond the limitations of the human condition and find peace. Overall, my own heart, let me have more, have pity on, is a powerful and deeply personal poem that speaks to the universal human experience of suffering and the search for meaning and purpose in life. It's written for us, for brethren. Oh my goodness, listen, did you? My own heart, let me have more pity on. Let me live it to my sad self hereafter kind. Charitable, not live this tormented mind with this tormented mind tormenting yet. I cast for comfort I can no more get by groping around my comfortless than blind eyes in their dark candy or thirst can find. Thirsts all in all in all a world of wet. Soul, self, come. Poor Jack self, I do advise you, jaded let be, call off thoughts a while elsewhere. Leave comfort root firm. Let joy sighs at God knows when to God knows what, whose smile's not rung, see you, unforeseen times rather as skies. Between pea mountains lights a lovely mile. It is an unusual style, isn't it? My own heart let me have more. We call it depression. Some people would call it this intense introspection that's hard to escape. To you. You decide. My goodness. Sometimes this all fits together so utterly beautifully, stunningly balanced. Today I say that because I'm looking at a bit of history that I'm going to read in. I'm going to share. This is from, we've been working through Living the Enlightenment. And here today is where we see an effort. And this is not to say this is definitive, but it's a very, very interesting observation. I'll try to do this justice, and I know, and I apologize, but I know I'm not. Now, we're looking at the major philosophies, people in the area that are influential. They have ideas because it's not that they become our ideas. They excite our thinking. And then we can progress our idea, move our ideas ahead, hopefully. Like many, and we're talking about a fellow, this was the Abbé Claude Yvon. Now, we're introduced to him because he was an exiled visitor to mid-century Amsterdam. He was a French philosopher, the Abbé Claude Yvon. And he quickly became a leader of a local lodge. Yvon had been a close associate of Diderot. Denis Diderot, that fellow that his major work was L'Encyclopédie. And it's a monument to the French Enlightenment. This is that guy. That's the introduction. Now, Diderot was born in 1713. He's tonsured through 1726, but he did not enter the church, and he later became an atheist and embraced rationalism. Let's just say a thinker, eh? But he was awarded a Master of Arts degree at the University of Paris, and he held various jobs, beginning with the Encyclopedia. Oh, my goodness. So this is a man of thought. And so we see him associated with the Abbé Claude Yvon and came to Amsterdam under some pressure and quickly was embraced by Freemasonry. And Claude Yvon wrote some of the most important articles for the famous encyclopedia. And this was the explanation of the revolutionary thinking. His article on the soul was far too generous in recapitulating the arguments put forth by materialists against its existence. Already under suspicion, because of his association with Diderot and with philosophical heresy, Yvon and his close friend, the Abbé of Prévis, were forced to flee Paris in 1752 under fear of arrest. So de Prévis had submitted a blatantly materialist thesis to the Sorbonne, and it had been carelessly passed. And when the authorities discovered that they had made out to be look foolish, the Parliament of Paris issued a warrant for his arrest. Ticked off. And in the company of de Prévis, Yvon made his way first to Amsterdam, like a lot of itinerant men in the 18th century. And he did not simply join, but actually helped found a new Masonic lodge, Concordia. Its proceedings, as we saw in the beginning, in 1755, in the home of one of the brothers, Barce, Concordia's minutes were invaluable because they provide us with the text of orations that Yvon himself gave to his brothers. Many such orations have been preserved, but in the instance, we can actually listen to one of the philosophies at the very center of the mid-century movement for enlightenment, as he explained to his brothers his understanding of how Freemasonry should transform them. Ah. Good man, better. Like so many orators in every continental country, Yvon is conscious of the public slander directed against the order. In quote, the world could not imagine that the righteous or rigorous order, which ties their secret assemblies together and cuts off entry to all profanes, could be innocent. In the same way, in former times, the pagan corruption blamed emerging Christianity for crimes that it wanted to cure itself of and extirpate entirely. You're just passing the buck. Having made the analogy to Christianity, the exiled abbe locates Freemasonry as the temple of virtue. Yes, my brothers, it is a temple that we are building dedicated to virtue. Its foundations are laid down in our hearts. Moral and civil virtues are its decorations. We ourselves, my brothers, are the living stones of this temple. The virtue proclaimed by Yvon is meant to be both private and public. We should not think this to be idle rhetoric. At the same time lodge meeting where Yvon spoke, the master, with the consent of the brothers, imposed penalties to assist in the search for private virtue. Monetary donations were to be given to the poor box of the lodge by men convicted of playing cards in the morning before noon and after midnight, or those who passed the night at the game, as well as those who do not sleep at home, either as the music goes or in other improper places. At least the self-policing being advocated should fail. Those among the brothers who will not denounce the one who is guilty, if they are convicted of this, will pay the double penalty. The somewhat obscure term musicos implied more than a cabaret. And the rest of the sentence clearly implies a house of prostitution. Neighboring lodges also had elaborate rules of conduct that prohibited cursing or discussions of statecraft and insisted upon good order and subordination of brothers toward their officers. For Yvon and his brothers, the Temple of Virtue was a rigorously demanding place. The obligations of Freemasonry are, as he explained, geared toward the perfection of human nature. If this is the case, why then are lessons so useful for the world's happiness, not spread far and wide, instead of being hidden from the profane by a, in parentheses, religious silence? The Enlightenment provides the rhetorical answer. To sample our lessons, my dear brothers, one must have a mind prepared for long instructions. One must rise above popular prejudice. One must even be a philosophy up to a certain point. Thus, all of this requires a kind of initiation and consequently a separation from profanes. For those who have become philosophies, Yvon offers a promise of transcendence by degrees. We will only make the veil before your eyes drop, little by little. Your eyes might be hurt by the glare by which the light shines, the light our mysteries hide inside. At first, through emblems and allegories, this light will be unveiled. Truth and virtue must be approached slowly by men who have been corrupted, who have been born in the midst of despotism. Only knowing liberty by name, you will find her in our meetings. These were strong words, and the reference to despotism was unmistakably political. The intention of this striving is to make a man transcend himself. This is the beautiful lot of humanity. Are we? Are we that temple of virtue? I don't see it. I don't think we enjoy the light. It's too bright. The light of awareness is there, but we turn away from it. We could shield our eyes. We could glance at it occasionally. But it's uncomfortable. And it's easier to turn away. I don't think that what I'm describing through this is a criticism in any way. I think, help me here, brethren, is this an observation, an uncommon observation? Well, that delightfully got away from me, got away from us. It's not the end, it's a pause. It's a pause. I don't know if we're a temple. Would they describe us as a temple of virtue? I don't know that, but I'm encouraged. I do think living a life of virtue is curious because it holds a sense of progress and a sense of enlightenment, of wisdom. And I don't know, maybe I'm an old fool because that is something that appeals to me, just to understand, just to go through life with a better understanding of the people around me and the things that are happening. I'm fortunate because I share the company of some very lovely brethren who are living this sense, living with a sense of purpose and a direction. They're not cynical. They don't approach the world as a great big value judgment, and they're always right. These are men that are engaging, and I like that. It brings that out. Of course, it reinforces it. I would only say to you in this, before we say goodbye here, be choosy about the company you keep. It does matter. It's not to say your mates aren't just lovely people, but are they good for you? And are they taking you, leaning you toward a direction that is positive for your character and your life? I hope you find those influences and take your time. You don't necessarily have to be crass about it. And delete all your friends from your contact list. No. And maybe in effect, you are that influence. When I say that, I what comes to mind is this horrible encounter I had with a fellow. He's a very bright man, but he proselytizes every time. It's like he catches you in the crosshairs and just drives this dogma at you. It's like, ugh. But I don't think anybody's ever told them that they're not listening. And he drones on. Oh my goodness, he'll drone on and on and on. Bible tent anger. Such a waste. Well, that's life. Yeah, try and approach it with a sense of humor. My goodness, at least you deserve that. And in the meantime, commit acts of random Masonic kindness. Ask your questions. Always ask your questions. Go for a long walk if you can. Contemplate life if you can, as you will, and ask the questions. Begin to ask the questions. Masonry isn't where you find answers to all the questions, but it's the methodology, and it is. It's quite remarkable. I hope you'll come back, and I look forward to having you sit in with us in just a few days, in another week. And in the meantime, I wish you all very well. Happy to part, et cetera, et cetera. Thank you.